Sunstone presents The Denial of Death, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
To start at 9:45, so if we get started now, we'll have the full hour for this presentation. We have today with us two people for this presentation. The paper is The Denial of Death. It has been prepared by Mary Beth Raines. Mary Beth has her M.S. in Family Relations from Brigham Young University. She has her Master's in Social Work from the University of Utah. She's a clinical social worker with the Salt Lake Mental Health Center and a marriage and family therapist in private practice. Moin Oviatt, who will be doing our commenting, has her B.S. from Brigham Young University, her Master's in Social Work from the University of Utah as well. She's a clinical social worker and a psychotherapist in private practice. When I asked Moin how she had the opportunity of commenting on this paper, she said to me, well, I share an office with Mary Beth. So I think the two of them have had a chance to work somewhat together on this concept. I think it will be very interesting for all of us. So we'll turn the time over to them right now. At the conclusion of the commenting, if you have any questions, if you'd stand, and then we'll repeat the question into the microphone so it can come across on the tape for this session.
Setting a man's execution date 2 weeks hence wonderfully concentrates the mind, wrote Samuel Johnson. Or I may add the fatal accident of a friend, the lingering cancer of a parent, or the crib death of a child. But what is the quality of that concentration, and what do we concentrate on? More particularly, how do Mormons respond to death, and how do we leave blurred or denied at the edges of our consciousness? What are the effects of this denial for the dying and for the bereaving? How can we acknowledge death? What are the positive effects of this acknowledgement, and how can we practically make death a part of living? Some of my life's experiences in Mormon culture are typical, I believe, and show clearly how our beliefs and customs mold our experience with death. As a child in Sunday school, sitting on old folding chairs in a rented AFL-CIO hall on the coast of Oregon, I sang the hymn, Christ the Lord is risen today, proudly proclaiming, O death, where is thy sting? To triumphal Easter music. The meter and the loud voices convinced me that Christ and church had already conquered all the problems that death could cause. I believed it even more because death had visited our family several times in my life. When I was three, my six-week-old brother died in his crib. I remember how surprised I was that he was cold when I reached to his casket. Then, when I was almost seven, my sister died suddenly of meningitis. She was only 1.5 years old. During these years, my mother's mother, my great-grandfather, and my father's father died, taking laughter and warmth with them. But surely I would get all these people back, I believed. The gospel promised it. To me, they had all gone so quickly, only a day or so. So it seemed that no one lingered over dying. It was a quick, short event in which the veil was parted and hands reached out for the person who was going home. Rituals surrounding these deaths added to the sense that death is simple and even good. When my great-grandfather died, I remember what seemed to be a party after the funeral. It was my first introduction to root beer made with dry ice on a hot summer day and a good reunion with cousins. During the large meal after my grandmother's burial, everyone said, this is just the way Pearl would have wanted it, to laugh at her funeral. Added to these were the glories of the funeral flowers, the Sunday best clothes, and the inevitable speeches of praise and preaching about those who had passed onward. This person was called home with better work to do. She is finally at peace and rest with the Lord, or with children. They were called home because they were so perfect they did not need to endure the trials of life. There were shadows, to be sure. My mother cried readily when she talked about losing her mother when she was 25. She told the stories with wonderful detail again and again, with pain in her voice about my brothers and sisters' deaths and about the shock. And the stories always ended with, they are waiting for us, and we must live well so that we can raise them when we enter the celestial kingdom. In some ways, it is almost as if the deaths of my relatives and of them waiting in heaven provided an important anchor to the afterlife in my growing up life. I came from there, I was returning to there, and I already knew some people who could come and greet me. As I became older, I began to sense the more substantive shadows of death. First, I came slowly to recognize that both my mother and father were still mourning the deaths of their children and of their parents, although they didn't express it much openly. Secondly, both my Grandma Raines and my much-beloved step-grandmother died very slowly over a year's time. The pain they experienced was not completely helped by reading, sleep, visitors, or medication. Both required a lot of care, and although they were so stoic that neither shared the full reality of what they were going through, I slowly realized my life had changed irrevocably by their deaths. I realized that death does have a sting. The death is a process, not just an event. Although I was relieved when they were released from their pain, I had to face my own. For the first time, I seriously thought about my own death. I concluded that the loss of those dear people was lingeringly painful, but even then my conclusions came short. I believed it would be a short mourning, and that's how it was with all deaths. My second conclusion was that I didn't mind dying, but it is how I die that scares me. I believed then, and still do, that the afterlife experience is so wonderful that there will be little regret for leaving this vale of tears. However, I use this attitude as a palliative to focus on the euphoria afterward and to deny the clincher, how I died. But now I can no longer escape death. I work professionally with patients and with families who are suicidal. I have to decide whether people will be hospitalized and to make crucial life and death decisions along with other psychiatrists and mental health professionals. This professional and personal mix has led to me to believe or to think about death and recognize that American and Mormon culture denies death as a way of focusing on life. I believe we have water here, but not a Kleenex. I believe we focus only partially on death, that our beliefs and customs do help us with important questions and do give succor to pain. But we do not fully face the pain of our loss. We do not fully face the physical pain of killing illness.
Thank you. Mary Beth needs to remember that the only thing we ever need in our office is a box of Kleenex.
That better? Okay, thanks. The truth for me now is that we can live life better when we truly confront death, past, current, and future deaths, including our own. This paper is about looking into the shadows of that as well as the light. Let me emphasize that we Mormons do not more seriously deny death than any other social or religious culture that I know about. Ernest Becker, in a long, detailed book titled Denial of Death, posits that all fears, anxieties, power struggles, and even hero stories and acts are a denial of death. He believes all of us spend a lot of time and energy staying alive by denying that we will die. My singling out, then, of features of our culture does not suggest that we are unique. Rather, I would like to suggest more positive and productive ways to integrate death and life. So let me list, in no particular order of importance, a number of Mormon beliefs, customs, and policies about death. I mentioned earlier the positive rituals and statements about death. We say that the survivors have received many times sweet assurance that the beloved dead is all right, that death is a blessing, that it is no real loss. Now, I know that Mormons are good at defining anything that happens to them as a blessing from God, but this is an ultimate form. Why not grieve for our loss publicly and privately? Why not feel all of the loss? Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's well-publicized work on the stages of dying also apply to the grieving. If people do not let themselves go through the shock, grief, anger, bargaining with God, etc., they are just postponing the work of this stage. A closet that needs cleaning doesn't get cleaner by locking it tighter. Unresolved grief leads more readily to bodily illness, depression, anxiety. This does not deny the spiritual assurance and the comfort the dying and grieving can receive. However, in addition to acceptance, it is appropriate to feel the full spectrum of our feelings and to say, I am numb, I cry, I can't sleep for my loss, my arms ache to hold him. Closely related to the belief that death is not a loss is the idea that any grief can be healed quickly. But the minimal healing period is over a year, not just a few weeks. The period can be longer depending on the circumstances of the death. Shameful deaths, such as suicide, can take longer. Some families never recover. Also, the kind of attachment to the person is important. In fact, grieving is hard work. So hard that therapists often use the phrase grief work to depict the effort and insight necessary to accept and grow from a major loss. And while doing our grief work, we need to see ourselves as normal, faithful, caring people who need to mourn even for a long time. We can return to normal circumstances outwardly in a while, but there will still be bad days, horrible days, and it is important to say so. Another aspect of death in our culture is a sense that if all was not well at the time of death, then a real tragedy occurred. More than once in sacrament meeting, I have heard about someone who had an argument with a brother or sister, and then immediately afterward, the person was drowned or otherwise killed. The story ends with, "I have spent years wishing, oh, why did I have to say that harsh word? If only I could tell him so." Somehow this story is supposed to decrease the amount of fights, so this tragedy will not happen to you. I have never noticed fewer fights because of it, however. More guilt, maybe, but not fewer fights. If we really believe in continuing relationships, if we really believe that the veil is quite thin between the other world and this, why not finish the story differently? Why not have the person talking to the deceased sibling and telling him out loud about his love, about his missing her, about all that she or he remembers? Why not have the person receive that sweet assurance that everything is all right? By doing so, we remove death as a threat to promote good behavior. Another way that we deny death is to say only good things about the dead person. In families, however, this can be lethal. Children and others do not get the clear view of what really happened in their family. The stories that assert, "Your grandfather was always firm in his testimony," sometimes leaves out the whole truth of having a testimony. It leaves out the process of doubt, the struggle to fit behavior into conviction, the revelations that brought certainty. Or was that firmness of conviction matched at times by a rigidity that left others' thoughts and feelings unheard? By telling only part of the story, we only have a partial heritage, and our children grow up with partial lies. I think that many believe that if we discuss the negative parts of a person's life, the sum total will seem negative, or that it will give permission to others to make mistakes, or even worse, to sin. Paradoxically, I don't believe it's true. Knowing the whole truth lets us affirm the worth of struggling, of wanting to live life better. When we stop talking or tell only one side of the story, we may be putting a scab over the wound of grief too soon, and deep wounds need to heal from the inside out with air to heal. Another major premise about death is that it is an event, not a process. This view means that those who die and those who survive wait for death instead of preparing for it, just as we often just wait for marriage. Actually, Mormon belief does focus somewhat on preparing for death. By rejecting deathbed repentance or other miraculous transformations at death, we turn the focus on our growth in this life, which I think is good. And for those who have lived a full life and feel confirmed by the Spirit, I believe they may be preparing for the time of death as well. They may not, however, be preparing any more than I have for how one dies. But the process of dying can be so variable. And what about those in Mormonism who do not feel that all of their lives have been lived well? Or for those who do not feel any assurance about the life hereafter? It is characteristic of Mormons to talk about the good and mute the negative. So, many people may suffer in silence, with fears, terror, and pain unarticulated and unanswered. In a culture where one's life is seen as a testimony of the truth, the traditional non-faith-building experiences may remain denied, and internal, and we lose ways to struggle to a broader faith. Kubler-Ross and others who work with the dying could not be more clear on this issue. Talking about the whole spectrum of pain and peace is crucial to eventually learning to die in peace. The need for openness about the whole range of feelings is crucial because the process of dying is often painful, physically and emotionally. researcher Charles Garfield found that many of the dying persons suffer ego-annihilating experiences. The techniques and resources gained over a lifetime to deny or deal with negative feelings and events are often lost, leaving a dying person overwhelmed. Even at the moment of death, not everyone dies blissfully. Some struggle for breath. Others seem psychologically tormented. Another writer, Stephen Levine, reports that the dying person is often aware that his or her death is upsetting to friends and family. They will often protect or nurture those who will continue living. And dying children, according to Levine, often take on their parents' fears and concerns. Many times they will hang on longer to postpone their parents' loss. Another aspect of Mormon culture is relevant. Many Mormons think that something bad happens to them, many Mormons think that when something bad happens to them, they are being punished or are unworthy for some reason. Extrapolating from this, if negative experiences happen during the dying process, how much more unworthy will some feel? It is quite common to reflect on one's life as it is ending and to assess its meaning. Given that we remember recently occurring events best sometimes, many will see their whole life more negatively because of their present negative circumstances or pain. As long as the dying stay silent, it may be so. Garfield believes that all of the terror, pain, and confusion of dying occurs to a much lesser degree when the dying are encouraged to talk and when they are lovingly attended by medical staff, family, and friends. As Mormons, I believe we do a generally excellent job of physically caring for the sick. But how many of us die psychologically alone, unable to share and be comforted for the full breadth of our experience? Although physically present, those still living commonly psychologically retreat from those dying, refusing to acknowledge that death happens to the survivors as well. If, as the dying or the surviving, we cannot discuss what is painful, shameful, or terrifying, what then? What about the impending loss, the unfinished business of past hurts, anger, and abandonments not yet healed? Every relationship has stress points and pain. If they cannot be discussed and resolved, it is much harder after the death. Possible, but harder. We may feel we are making the experience harder by being open with the dying, but it may be harder in the long run by not talking. Psychological pain is often physically expressed, for instance. Our unresolved issues with others can impair our quality of life as we repress our hurts. We may even come to our own deaths less finished. Resolving these issues may relieve both psychic and physical pain. The survivors need to experience a peaceful death also. No matter how close we are to the person dying, we are aware it is not us, and most of us are glad of it. We still have work to do. But what we deny inwardly by saying, "I'm glad it's not my turn," is that it is our turn to suffer a death, the death of a relationship. It is here that the Mormon belief in not only a life after death, but an eternity of sealed relationships is a double-edged sword. Our ability to deal with death is greatly enhanced because we have a strong, understandable context of eternal existence in which to place death. But our strong stance also denies the death of this relationship now. It will never be the same again. We cannot predict where and when we will meet again. We lose permanently in this life this person's companionship. We lie to ourselves by only focusing on the future and using the language of impermanence, such as, "till we meet again." The existentialists have a lot to teach us on this point, and one of those teachings is that we must say goodbye now, and with all the finality that lets us feel the pain of our loss, with all the awareness that we must resolve the issues now in this relationship and be prepared to live life alone. It affects the rest of our lives if we do not say goodbye. Otherwise, we carry ghosts and shadows into all of our new experiences, into all of our other relationships. The actual moment of death has a tremendous impact on the living. No matter how prepared we think we are for another's death, the new reality has a resounding finality. Relief, joy, pain may occur with more intensity than before experienced. We should let ourselves experience all of it. Let the mortician put the rouge on the body to make it lovely. We need to feel the whole of what we are experiencing directly. One of the most enlightening death experiences I have known occurred recently. A male client of mine reported the death of his sister-in-law, with whom he was very close. They were almost best friends and had discussed philosophy of life, church doctrine, and mutual complaints about the family for years. Although she had been chronically ill for some time, she needed sudden emergency surgery. That was followed by 2 weeks of intensive care. On a Wednesday morning, she died, although no one really expected it. He came in at lunchtime from his business to eat with her, not knowing of the morning's event, and the rest of the family had just left unbeknownst to him. She was alone, and he realized quickly that she was dead. Impulsively, intuitively, he decided to have lunch with her anyway. He says that he sat next to her, ate his sandwich, and talked to her as if she were alive, saying goodbye. He thanked her for all the good times. I knew her also, so this is also personal for me. He thanked her for all the good times, reviewed poignant moments, cried, pleaded for her not to go, and told her of his disappointments and frustrations. He says it was the best lunch of his life, but certainly not the most enjoyable. His naturalness deeply touched me. Evidently, some others have not been so touched, as he says he has received some criticism for eating lunch with a dead person. He still feels it was the right thing to do, and I agree. For the most part, even though our experiences at the moment of death are not like my clients, they are times of giving and receiving support when all the positive rituals come into play. And for those who are alone, or unfinished with the person who is now dead, however, a traumatic time may start. But what happens at the moment of death to the living in Mormon culture does not bother me as much as what may occur afterwards. I cannot recall a funeral I have attended in which the following statement has not been made. We know that she has gone on to a better place where the Lord needs her more than we do. Our sadness is but a short moment. Again, death is not a loss, but a blessing. Even if the death was tragic or unexpected, the words are the same. Now, I do not want to deny the truth of these statements in many circumstances, but for many deaths, I cannot believe they are true. We comfort with heartening words, even though it may not match the reality. How can God need a mother of 7 young children more than they do? We need to find other words of comfort that do not strain our credulity in the mourning process. What may really be happening in a large percentage of these cases can be understood by looking at the logistics of funerals. Most are held 3 to 4 days after. This period of time is well within the limits of the shock stage after death, often characterized by numbness, disbelief, a glazing over of the pain. What is plausible to state about grief at this stage will generally be ripped open by the dawning of intense pain in 2 to 4 weeks or thereabouts. Maybe we should recognize these statements as stage-specific and be open to feeling quite differently later when the pain comes. If we view the loss as something to get over quickly, we will use common techniques of avoidance, blocking, or repressing. Most techniques to control physical pain are to avoid... Let me start over. Most techniques to control physical pain are to avoid or numb it until it simply ends. I do not disagree with this stance for the most part, and am personally willing to reach for the aspirin when my chronic knee pain becomes severe. But some pain should not be avoided. We must be open to it and work with it. And not just because acknowledging and expressing grief lets the psychological healing occur. As important as healing is the emotional and spiritual growth we experience when we plumb the depths of our pain, fear, and loss. If we deny ourselves that, we deny a crucial route to becoming more whole, spiritual, and Christ-like. We commonly accept the idea that Christ did not flinch from any experience or any feeling or any loss. By openly acknowledging the full breadth of what we experience, we are agreeing to grow up, to develop an increasing capacity to meet pain and loss with love and service, and not denial or escape. But too often we fail to express anything but the positive. All the rest is denial, whether it's active, such as blocking or lying, or passive, such as not talking or omitting parts of the story. All of these forms of denial stop our growth as surely as denying ourselves books and exercise. Although I have alluded to a number of effects we suffer individually and collectively by denying death, I would like to summarize them briefly. First, we restrict our ability to feel, to experience life fully. We wrap a cloak of niceness around death, hoping to warm it, and only partially succeed. Second, we set limits on our spiritual maturity because we do not use the negative as a catalyst for growth. We condemn ourselves to the prison of our present strengths. Third, we settle for a limited ability to cope with the feelings and reality of death or other tragedies. We plead with God to take this cup for us, or we stay and remain confused about our losses. Sheldon Kopp has a most incisive insight about this mental stance. He says that when people ask God, "Why me?" God replies, "Why not?" Fourth, the repressed or blocked parts of our grief come out in other generally negative ways. Some people experience more anxiety or depression, and if they refuse to deal with those feelings, eventually these panicky feelings or low mood can acquire a sense of rootlessness. Clinically, it is described as free-floating. Or we may have more physical complaints that are transformed from our submerged pain. Or we may blame our torment on Satan. Fifth, more relationship disruptions can occur. We may avoid closeness, not wanting to suffer that intense pain of loss again in another relationship. Or, given our current emphasis on the family within the church, this may cause even more guilt or agitation. Death changes the whole family system. Unresolved grief affects the family not only for the next year or two, but can influence several generations. From a family therapy perspective, unmourned or unresolved death, such as stillborns, can cause a veiled reenactment of these traumas. For example, a child born immediately in birth order after a child who has died may be a psychological replacement and may be asked, unconsciously, to play the roles of two children at once. Of course, knowing these sociological observations may not cause these reactions to disappear, but hopefully they may be softened. What can we do? First and foremost, start talking. Start sharing the deaths we have experienced and include all of our experiences, even the unresolved questions, anger, insults, and pain. Start talking publicly, not just privately. Recently, I heard a story that was supposed to have occurred at American Fork. In the middle of the usual thankful expressions, one brother stood up and said, "I don't know about you, but for as much faith as I have in the gospel, things are rough. We're fighting at home, money is tight, I'm overwhelmed." Then he sat down. Following a short period of shock, several other testimonies followed, which also acknowledged messy, raw issues in their lives. My fantasy, actually, that occurred last night with Carolyn Pearson, I believe, that the same dynamic of one person being willing to take that courageous risk and allows the rest of us to open up and tell the truth about our lives. My fantasy is that a similar occurrence could happen concerning death in testimony meeting. Someone hopefully could feel the courage to say, "I am starting to be able to think clearly about the bad times between my father and myself. I am starting to let myself feel some of the forgiveness towards him, to feel some forgiveness towards myself for staying bitter so long. But knots of anger remain. I am worn out with it, but I hope to find relief." And my fantasy includes reactions from ward members that perceive the speaker as strong, not weak. We need to start talking to our families about past deaths, about our full experience with parents, siblings, and grandparents who are dead. Then children and parents can see intergenerational connections more easily and have more material to deal with current conflicts. We don't protect the dead by keeping mum. We stunt our own growth. Other changes may be helpful. We can start preparing for our own death. We can start perceiving any pain or illness as a preparation for loss. Good preparation for future losses of greater material magnitude. Accepting a week's loss of work because of flu or greater without punishing ourselves is good preparation for future invalid periods or physical decline. We can experience life in imperfect states as being beautiful also. We can start seeing life as a fluid, often random and messy, process of growth from one stage of being to another rather than a set of stair steps of various accomplishments. We can learn how to experience grief and loss and use it as a catalyst to teach us more empathy, less ego involvement in having a perfect life, less attachment to materialism, less fear for the future. Whenever I was sick as a child, my Grandma Raines would always ask, "What is this illness trying to teach you?" I'm not sure I always got the lesson. We can let our new awareness teach us to integrate minor losses and illnesses into the major loss of death. In sum, we can start seeing death, even our own future death, as a spur to grow spiritually. Here are two inner exercises to experiment with at home. Take an hour or more to be by yourself. If you know you have a hard time relaxing and or focusing your mind for a long time, as most of us do, ask a trusted friend to be with you to guide you. Start relaxing quietly until most of your muscles are relaxed and your mind is floating somewhat freely. Then think about, clearly visualize, all the ways that you might die, whether you might go quickly or go very slowly, in ease or in pain, now or in 50 years. Notice which ways you can give yourself into the dying more easily and which ways you resist. Where you resist are areas for acceptance and growth. A note here. I'm not implying that we should not flinch at pain, fear, etc. I mean only that we can cope well with a far greater amount of pain and take it less personally than we do now. When you are finished, jot down your reactions or discuss it with your friend. The second experiment is to consciously bring some aspect of death into your awareness for 5 minutes of every day for a month. Over the month's time, you will probably develop a larger empathy for life and for people dying, or a greater understanding of suffering. If you become panicked, depressed, or even too eager to die, these are areas of growth. But though it may be uncomfortable, you will grow. If your feelings are unmanageable, see a therapist for guided help. Another way to grow from pain and death is to lean into it, to not run from it. Although, as I said, most pain control techniques are focused on getting away from the pain, Stephen Levine, previously mentioned as working extensively with the dying, suggests techniques for growth by focusing on the pain itself. He recommends that you notice the pain clearly, identifying specific qualities. Is it hot? Cold? Is it sharp or dull? What color is it? Start to soften it around the edges. Loosen it up within the body. Gradually, we not only have more control over the pain, but over time we can feel under it a greater connectedness with others in pain and with a deeper sense of life. Rather than simply crying to God for relief, we participate in giving ourselves the healing. Still another suggestion for acknowledging death is to start talking to those who are already dead. If you believe the veil is thin, it is possible that the other person is just waiting to find some way to resolve the unfinished business also. For the more skeptical, this process can still be healing. There are several forms of therapy, such as Gestalt therapy, that focus on resolving an issue with someone even though that person is not there. The benefits of talking directly to the lost person or absent person are twofold. One, you need to say what you were thinking and feeling in order to let go of the issues you have with that person. Second, if you know the person well, the whole pattern of interaction is already within your memory and feelings. You know at some level how the person would have responded, so you can now stage a conversation of resolution. Again, a trusted friend or therapist can give perspective and support. My last suggestion for acknowledging death is to work with people who are dying. Terminally ill people and those mourning help us just by being there. Their presence can help us face our own upcoming deaths of people we know, of cherished relationships, of ourselves. Beyond the physical care for the terminally ill, many times there is nothing we can do for the dying. We have only ourselves to give, our peace, our love, our current level of spiritual maturity. When we willingly face and stay with all the horrible details of long, slow deaths, of young deaths, of shameful deaths, our spiritual capacity grows. Relevant to the benefits of facing death directly is the research of near-death experiences, particularly the work of Raymond Moody and of Kenneth Ring. The consistent pattern of life changes after the return to life, they found, is transformation from material to people-oriented values, an added sensitivity to nature and joy of the moment, and an increase in spiritual beliefs and experiences. These changes are also noted in many of those who work with the terminally ill. We can claim some of this growth in ourselves. Briefly, I think that these changes in focus that I have suggested could have some peculiarly Mormon benefits. First, we could become less organizationally focused and more independently spiritually minded. Next, there might be a change in our culture of niceness. going beyond the testimony building experiences and sweet spirits to admit all of the joy and pathos openly. Finally, Mormons may become less perfectionistic as we delve into the imperfect, unperfectible side of life. The benefit of this is to live more fully in the moment, thereby actualizing the saying, "Man is that he might have joy now rather than in the eternities." In doing this, my hope would be that we might become less critical of our individual failings, attaching less of our ultimate worth to our sins, and more spiritual maturity by accepting the shadows in our lives as well as the light. Thank you.
Oh, I don't know if I'll need this or not, but I'm glad to have.
I find much to praise and very little to criticize in Mary Beth's paper. Now, that may be because we do share office space and a similar philosophy of therapy and a long and, for me, tremendously enriching friendship. Yes, I would be happy to turn down the mic. You know, one of the delights of a good paper, and I think this is an excellent paper, is that it stimulates our own thinking about the subject at hand. And Mary Beth's paper certainly stimulated my thinking about death and about our theology in terms of death. And so all I'm going to do today is just kind of share with you a couple of my thoughts that have been stimulated by her paper. And your thoughts would be very different. One of the interesting things about this particular paper, I was thinking, was that there are many papers that are presented at such symposiums as this for which we have no personal experience. I mean, there are many kinds of things that we talk about that don't really touch us. I cannot imagine there is anyone here in this room that has not personally been deeply affected by death. I certainly have. Mary Beth talked about her experiences with that. So my little thoughts are no more or less valid than anyone else's. And that, again, is one of the really significant things that I think about this paper, is that it really is one of the things that is unavoidable, this issue of death. Let me just start with my first thought, which is about trying to define what the role of theology is in the experience of death. It seems to me the purpose of theology is partly to explain human experience and to guide and provide a framework for our reaction to life's events. Although our theology explains some very important big life questions, I mean, it's all man's search for happiness, where did I come from, why am I here, where am I going, it seems to me that there is very much that defies explanation. And pain and suffering and death and the problems around those are things that are very much realities and cannot be denied, much as we would like to deny them. But I still think that those issues defy adequate theological explanation and still remain very mysterious. The plain fact is we don't know why people die when they die. And we don't know why they die the way they die. And so my major criticism theologically is that we pretend that we know. And then we offer our pretend knowledge with great conviction. And then we impose our pretend knowledge with our great conviction upon those who are suffering and mourning. I do think that saying things like the Lord needed her more, his mission was complete, she was too good for this life and had no need to experience suffering here, are ways of denying experience, the experience that that person had of dying, and actually hurt. These are not, in my mind, just benign banalities that we say in platitudes. They actually damage. And
many of us in our profession could give you examples of that. When I knew I was going to deliver this response, I began to talk to some people I knew about their experience of death, and it became very clear to me that this was a very damaging thing theologically to say to these people, because it denies the very thing that Mary Beth talked about, which was so important, which is the need to say goodbye now. You say, you know, the Lord needed them more, they go on, you'll see them again, that kind of thing. Theologically, that's comforting on one hand, but that double-edged sword thing, our favorite Sunstone word paradox, it becomes a real problem. I'm well acquainted with a couple who divorced. It was a second marriage. There had been the death of the first wife, and the second marriage had gone on for a very many years. And this couple is now divorcing, and the issue seems to be that the first death of the first wife was never resolved, particularly around the children. They never accepted the second marriage. They never say goodbye to their experience with their mother, and it's been a very painful experience now for this second family. Besides just being benign platitudes and besides doing damage to the families involved, I think that they aren't true. Or at least, if they're true, we don't know that they're true. We don't know that the person's mission was really completed. We don't know that God needed them more. We just don't know. And I think to say, I don't know why, is one of the most painful things that we have to do. But I think we have to do it. I think it's imperative that we start pretending that we know what we do not know. It is extremely painful in my own life, when I needed my father, to say, I don't know why my father died. Except that I think it is important that we do that. I think if we do not, we insult the dead, we insult the living, and we insult God by pretending that we know what we do not know. My second thought is about our theological approach to a particular kind of death, which is suicide. This is one area where our theology is of very little help in the incidence of suicide. Almost all of us, I think, have been touched by someone who has taken their own life. I don't think that's peculiar to my profession. I deal with it a lot, though, because it's epidemic in our society, and it's increasing in number. And the number of suicides among younger and younger people in the population is certainly increasing. I'm grateful that this is becoming more acknowledged in our society. In January, I attended a conference on youth suicide and depression at BYU for 4 days. It's a very fine conference, and I think it's important that we are beginning to talk about this. Certainly in this instance, the survivors of a suicide death find our platitudes that the Lord needed him more, he completed his mission in life, she was such a good person that she need not suffer the consequences of this life, not only have a hollow ring, they have no meaning whatsoever. And our general reaction to suicide, theologically and emotionally, has been to ignore it. We don't talk about it at all. At least we don't talk about it to the survivors. We talk a lot about it to each other in a very gossipy kind of fashion. But we don't talk about it to the survivors. In this case, we truly deny death and the experience of death and mourning to the survivors. Again, let me just say personally, I have a very close friend who married a man in another state who had been married previously, had several children. His wife died, I was told, of depression. Well, I've dealt with a whole bunch of people who are depressed, and I know how people die of depression. And I finally said, what do you mean she died of depression? How does one die of depression? And she said, I don't know. And I said, well, I do, and maybe you better ask him. And finally, he acknowledged that his wife had committed suicide. And she was truly depressed. I mean, you know, happy folks don't generally do that very often. But the consequences in their marriage, again, particularly concerning the children, were devastating because they never acknowledged the suicide of their mother or were able to work through it in any fashion. Now, theologically, we have very little explanation and very little support for such people. I do want to share with you that our theology around suicide, in my opinion, has improved a lot. I want to read you just a couple of little things to demonstrate that. This is from George Buchanan in 1893. I hope we've come a long way. What he's talking about is refusing burial, Christian burial, to people who have committed suicide. He talks about the custom of refusing, quote, the custom of refusing Christian burial to self-murderers prevailed upon the continent of Europe. The Catholic Church rigidly excluded murderers from burial in what was known as consecrated ground. This is the rule where the Greek Church, the Lutheran Church, and the Church of England have control. The mortal remains of no suicide is permitted to be buried in ground which have been consecrated as the last resting place of those who led proper lives. In this way, these churches show their condemnation of this crime. I think the Latter-day Saints should do no less. Now, in the 1961 General Handbook, oh, I'm sorry, 1968 General Handbook, 1968 General Handbook, it says, quote, every member of the church should be made to understand that it is a dreadful sin to take one's own life. It is self-murder, and therefore, anyone committing this crime should not expect a public and honorable funeral. Why distinction between the condition of one who dies a natural death and one who dies by his own hand? No one should be led to believe that if he commits this sinful act, he will receive the same respect and honor at his burial from the priesthood and the people of God that others who do not die as faithful members of the church. No encouragement of this kind should be given to anyone who has the inclination to commit suicide. Gosh, I never thought that the way my funeral was going to be held was going to be encouragement to die, but I go on. For this reason, a person who commits suicide should be buried privately and without ostentations, and certainly the funeral services should be conducted without the authorities of the church lending their presence to the funeral. All should be taught that it is a sin of great magnitude to take the life which the Creator has given them. End quote. That was 1968. Now, let me say that in the teachings of Spencer Kimball, which is 1982, I just lost my contact. Oh, it's back. Ooh, that's a scary feeling. Spencer Kimball addresses suicide, and I'm not going to read you because it's kind of long, but I'll just read you the subtitles. One regarding suicide. Number one, shortening a life is sin, so that's repetition of what we said. Suicide affects others, meaning your family. And then he says mentally ill suicides are not fully responsible for their actions, and that suicide is no escape, it's just a change of scenery. And that's about all he says. Now, my last quotation is from Bruce McConkie, second edition of Mormon Doctrine, in which he says,
some water.
Thank you. In which he said, he talks a little bit about accountability, and then I quote, this life is a probationary state or a time during which man is tried and tested physically, spiritually, and mentally. No man has the right to run away from these tests, no matter how severe they may be, by taking his own life. Obviously, persons subject to great stresses may lose control of themselves and become mentally clouded to the point that they are no longer accountable for their acts. Such are not to be condemned for taking their own lives. It should also be remembered that judgment is in the Lord, is the Lord's. He knows the thoughts, intents, and abilities of men, and in his infinite wisdom will make all things right in due course. End quote. That seems to me to be a much more enlightened viewpoint about the issue of suicide. And I'm grateful that we are beginning at least to approach this. I'm terribly cold.
Is everybody else cold in here?
I thought it was the shadow of the angel of death passing over me.
It's on the other side.
On the other side of the coin, I think that in an effort to resolve this issue of suicide, some in the world, or of the world, whichever that goes, I forget, have have tried to ease the death of suicide or the pain of the death of suicide by almost making a parody. I have to read you the most bizarre article from Deseret News. No, I take it back. It's not. It's from the Salt Lake Tribune. Speaking of cloning. And this is last week, August the 17th, on Sunday. Maybe some of you read it. It's from a column called Your Changing World. There's no byline. I certainly wish there was. So I don't know who wrote it, but this person is... The question, it's question-answer sort of format. Question, with people living longer and longer, will our attitudes toward death change? And then the person says yes. Someday death may be considered a pleasant experience and people may actually look forward to dying, and then they go on and on about this. And then I'm going to quote a couple of paragraphs. Quote, a first step toward this end, making death pleasant, might be to legalize suicide and provide ways for persons whose life has lost its meaning to get help in ending it. For example, a person wishing to die could apply to the government for a suicide license. The board would consult with physicians and others, including family members, to determine whether a license should be granted. Permission would normally be granted only to elderly persons in poor health, though exceptions could be made in such cases as that of a younger person suffering from a painful disease with little hope of recovery. The board would refuse a license to many applicants. In these instances, the board might provide special counseling for would-be suicides to deter them from killing themselves. For threats of suicide often are really a distressed person's call for help. But if a license were granted, the would-be suicide would get all kinds of help from physicians and others in ending his life as pleasantly as possible. For example, a thanatologist or death specialist would be able to dispense a variety of potent drugs. Some would be designed to kill a person painlessly. Others would produce a feeling of euphoria as death occurs. Already some hospices in Britain provide dying patients with cocktails made of drugs that make them happy, even as they speed their dying. I don't know where they got that information. I mean, they do give them pain cocktails, but they don't necessarily speed their dying. Since the purpose of hospices is to keep the dying comfortable rather than to cure their illness, hospices could adopt approaches that hospital staffs would find unacceptable. There might be other ways to make dying pleasant. During a festival of death, a dying person might have the opportunity to say farewell and share happy memories with their friends, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, not many of us have a good handle on this issue of suicide. I don't want to be particularly critical of the church, because it seems to me that people out there, outside the church, you know, meaning in, you know, the inner and outer world, they don't have any more idea of the consequences and the pain of suicide than we seem to be dealing with. And this certainly represents to me as much a denial of death and of pain and of suicide as putting a stake through someone's heart and burying him at the crossroads, which is kind of what George Buchanan seemed to imply. Let me just go on with a couple more thoughts. A thought about preparing for death. This is the only place in the paper where I somewhat disagree with Mary Beth. Mary Beth is a wonderful and creative therapist. I recommend you all start a savings account for therapy with Mary Beth. however, and I do think it's important to think about death, one's own and other people's. And some of the suggestions she made, especially about some of the Cashel techniques of speaking and creating a dialogue with the dead, it's probably a very good, well, it's not probably, it's one of the ways I resolve my own father's death. It's an excellent suggestion. One of the suggestions I'm not so sure about is the idea of meditating and contemplating about one's own death as a way of preparing for death. It's rather like meditating and contemplating on having one's arm amputated. It seems to me that all of the rich information and gory detail in the world is not going to quite help when somebody actually cuts off your arm. And so I'm not sure that way is really going to really help, because the information of death is experiential. I will say what I think does help, and here I can only echo and re-echo Mary Beth's last point. I have suggested that we should stop pretending what we do not know. So I will end with what I do know. And of all the things I've said, this is the only thing I know to be absolutely true. And that is that the only way that really makes a difference in dealing with death is to share it. Our voluntary act of sharing the experience of dying and of the pain of dying is extremely difficult and enormously generous on the part of the giver, and I think of Carolyn Pearson's experience with her husband in that regard. And I think it is also extremely needed by the sufferer. Even Christ needed that sharing experience. We're told in Luke, 22nd chapter, about his experience in the Garden of Gethsemane. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, "Pray that ye enter not into temptation." And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw and kneeled down praying, saying, "Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me." And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground. I would not have wanted to be that angel. I don't know if you got to volunteer for that kind of thing. I think that that must have been a horribly difficult experience to share and attempt to strengthen our Lord in his greatest suffering and preparation for death. And yet it is my conviction that in that fully facing our own deaths and those of others, it is in that way that we become such angels to each other. And that it is only in our willingness to accept this role, our willingness to share our greatest suffering and our deaths, that we can truly stop denying death and make it a part of living.